Be great if we turn to the person next to us and ask the question, how do you deal with conflict? Because I reckon you know already a lot of the times. Why are you smiling? Is that you? Oh, because... Oh, right. So just do that for the 30 seconds and just bring to the boil some of the ideas that you may already have. Thanks. Slowly come back. All right, let that. I was going to ask, but I might just save that for the end. If perhaps you, I think you already know a lot of the skills. So, and this is a very short, cursory view. So, but let me tell you some of the things that have been percolating for me, and then afterwards we can have a bit of a discussion about it. As I read the Bible and seek to live out God's kingdom values, I am increasingly convinced that God is all on about making things right. Making all things right. God doesn't essentially want to rule over us, but he does want to rule through us. We will in the end reign with him. And he wants us to be agents of reconciliation and peacemakers in a world where there are more slaves now than in Wilberforce's day, and there are more world wars now than then, and poverty is the main culprit. And I believe that every personal action, even on the playground, can actually stand over and against the macro, every micro local action can stand over and against the macro element of retaliation and retribution. Under Bevan's influence, I watched the best exotic Marigold Hotel, and I love this line. It says, this guy says, what he's done, I'll just give you a bit of background, he's advertised this Marigold Hotel to Westerners. And they come and they see that it's nothing like the brochure. And he says, no, you've got to understand, I wasn't false advertising. It was a big vision of the way it will be. And he says, everything will work out all right in the end. And if it's not all right, then it's just not the end. And I just think that's a fantastic line, because it's a very biblical worldview. So this is a bit of a potpourri of Bible stuff and counselling stuff that I've learned. In 2 Corinthians 5, there are consecutive doublets that reiterate that God is restoring the world back to himself in Christ, and that all believers have a vocation to be agents of reconciliation. Restorative justice is where the victim initiates forgiveness and initiates the conflict resolution. And here in Corinthians, God is both the victim and the initiator, the originator, towards the offender, which is us. This is the pattern of restorative justice. Now, this is very different to our view of, and Paul will like this, it's not substitutionary atonement. God is not the recipient of Christ's death. It is not to placate an angry God. It is not something done by Christ for or to God, but it is the work of Christ, God in Christ. So it's non-retributive. And victim initiated. And in Matthew's gospel that we just read, if you have you're about to be at the altar and you recognize somebody else has a problem with you, you go and fix it up. And I remember talking to an Anglican priest, no one in here, and he said, "Do you know why we pass the peace before we have communion?" I said, "I have absolutely no idea." He said, "Well, it's because of that verse. That then is the time to make it up with your brother or sister before you have communion, before you go to the altar," which makes perfect sense. But we tend to do things out of tradition sometimes. And Paul, when he mentions the justice of God 10 times particularly, and it's a polemic idea, that of... the empire's or our notion of retributive justice, of revenge and seeking to punish the offender, as opposed to God's view, which is it's putting things right. Yes, it's about making things right. Is Tyson here? Can I borrow Tyson? Have you got a minute? You may have seen this idea before, but I've found this to be helpful. Sorry to bug you, I haven't primed you. If you can just push me over, if that's all right, yeah? Okay, so that's one way of dealing with conflict, that Tyson pushes me and he wins and I lose. The other way is called flight, or I just walk away. The other way is called fight, and... you know about this, we just don't go anywhere, we just fight. But it seems the third way is the Jesus way, and this is where you try and push me over. It didn't work so well, but it's the idea is that I get him off balance by him, thank you very much, you get it. So, I'm not sure about this, but I've heard the Anabaptists interpret Jesus when he says, if someone strikes you on the left cheek, and the only... hang on, I always get this wrong. But the only way to strike you on the left cheek is if you're having a backhander, right? So if someone strikes you on the left cheek, offer to him the right. So, in other words, you force the other person to... fight you not as a slave or a woman back in those days, that those people got backhanders, but force the other person to fight you as an equal and resolve conflict as an equal. And I try to find ways when kids come to me and say I've been bullied, try and find creative ways of trying to make that sort of stuff happen. Here's one way. I got this from Walter Wink. A little story. A woman was being stalked, and she had all this shopping in her hands on the way to her house. And just in a flash of brilliance, she turned on the guy and said, "Oh, I'm so glad you arrived. Now you can help me with my shopping." And she gave the shopping to him, and he was disarmed. And she created a friendship with him. So I know that's very difficult to do, but that's a sort of thing. There's another story in Walter Wink where this woman is upstairs and a guy is standing over her at 3 a.m. And she realised in that moment that both her and this guy, what happens next could determine their fate. You know, he could end up in jail, she could end up dead, or... whatever. So she realized that they were connected in that flash of, and she said, "Oh, what's the time?" And he said, "Well, your clock says 3:05, but mine says 3:01. And she says, "How did you get in?" And he said, "I got in through the study window, I smashed it." She said, "Oh, that's a problem, because I don't have any money." He said, "No kidding, that's the reason I broke in. I was looking for money." She said, "How about you sleep downstairs, I'll sleep up here, and over breakfast, we'll try and figure out a way to solve both of our problems." And so, you know, that's amazingly heroic. Now, I don't know if I could do that. But in my small little world of counselling kids, what I tend to do is kids come in and say, "I'm being bullied and I don't know what to do about it." Amongst other things, I say, "Who in your class is a leader?" And usually the people that they identify are the people who are bullies. So I said, "Okay, do you feel too disempowered to..." Basically, the end is they feel too disempowered to confront. So I confront them and I say, "So-and-so, this guy has identified you as a leader." "Really?" "Yeah, he's identified you as a leader. And I'm wondering whether, you know, people bully this guy. And I'm wondering whether there's any way that you could defend him, stick up for him and say..." I mean, if you hear other people doing it, say, "Stop, leave him alone. He's all right." Do you reckon you could do that? And basically, they say yes. So it's about flipping someone's, what's the opposite of asset? Liability, into an asset. So let's talk about conflict resolution and the nitty-gritty of it. Well, in Matthew 18, which we didn't read, which I believe is the pattern for this church, it does say, "If your brother or sister sins against you, go and show him his fault just between the two of you. If he listens to you, you've won your brother or sister over. But if he doesn't listen, take one or two along, others along, so that every matter may be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. And if he refuses to listen, even to the church, treat him as you would a pagan or a tax collector." Before we talk about the actual conflict resolution, a couple of things you need to... I've figured out for myself, and that is we are all fragile and easily hurt. In the overwhelming majority of time, we are all victims, we are all offenders, and hurt people hurt people. One of my favourite verses used to be, still sort of is Isaiah, from Isaiah 53, "For by his stripes we are healed." Because if God's love can heal you, then that may stop you becoming violent towards other people or creating conflict. And I also believe that we, with God's love, even with God's love, we're all still very broken and easily hurt. And the trick is, I describe it like you have cracks on your pitch. And it's really important to be aware of your cracks on your pitch and set up little warning signs around them that says "under repair," especially to those who love you the most. And I don't think it's a bad thing to just let people know and verbalise your own, you know, your own faults and fears and failings. I know I one of my problems, and this is, I'm being quite open here, is that if I'm doing something for someone in love and then they criticise me for that, I react and get hurt and feel like a failure. And I try to counteract that. And I'll give you an example, and I hope I don't tread on Erica's toes. I haven't pre-warned her that I'm doing this, but it's more about me than her. I had a hell day, and I was making a meal for the community. The community came, got fed, and she came in late, and I didn't set aside some gluten-free sausages for her. And she said, "Oh, You didn't leave me any gluten-free sausages. I felt like she was saying I was a failure. She was just expressing her disappointment. And I tended to react, and I said, well, I'll just go down the shop and get you some. She said, no, it's okay. And I tended to, my interpretation was, she was just trying to say, I'll get through it, I'll, you know, it'll be fine. I thought that meant, well, you failed and you had your chance and you blew it. And there's no redemption. You can't, there's no way out. So I said, well, I'm going to go down the shop and get you gluten-free sausages, whether you eat them or not. And, I thought you'd like that. Yeah. So it was me attempting to prove myself and redeem myself from my failure. So I needed to let her know, to help her understand that I feel emasculated, like a failure, like worthless, when I'm trying to do something in love and it's not good enough. And what I'd like from her is, particularly her but others, is some affirmation of the motivation behind what I'm doing. So I appreciate your efforts. You know, I can really see you've gone to a lot of trouble here, but and then criticise me. So I really, really have understood that other people are not usually bowling at your cracks on their pitch. They aren't purposefully, malevolently aiming for them. But because they have scars and you have scars, we rub up against each other. And it's really important that you share what you need with other people. And you start... before I get to that. Ephesians 4:6 says, don't let the sun go down on your anger, which I take to mean don't bottle it up. Get rid of your anger now. If something annoys you even slightly, get it out now. Otherwise, it'll just accumulate and build up and then you'll explode. I tend to be passive-aggressive in terms of that. So don't avoid it. You take responsibility for it. Confront it one-on-one with the other person in private. Say something because it helps. Not only helps you to be less dehumanised, but it also helps them, because if they're continuing to be a monster and push and oppress and put other people down, then that's making them less human. It's really important that... Martin Luther King talks about, I think he talks about standing up with a straight back, because other people can ride you if you let them. And I remember a kid at school, we were trying to talk through how, because he was playing donkey, you know, that game where you throw the ball and if you get it wrong, if you miss, you get a D. And kids just kept calling him donkey day after day after day. And he was really dehumanised, and I said, you need to say something. You need to say something creative, but not nasty, just defend yourself about that. And I said, have you got any ideas? And in a flash of inspiration, he said, yeah, I could say, if I was a donkey, if kids could call me a donkey, I'd say, if I was a donkey, I'd kick you. I said, well, that's not bad. That's not bad. It's sort of like not a threat. But it sounds like a threat, enough to help them go, I wonder whether he's actually giving me a threat, but he's just defending himself. And the other thing is that anger is a secondary emotion. We get hurt, or we feel fear, or we have shame, and then we get angry. And a lot of people don't understand that. I say to a kid, why did you pick up that chair and throw it through the window, or throw it at the teacher? He said, I just got angry. Somebody called me gay or whatever. And I said, do you realise that you were hurt first? No, I was just angry. No, I think you were hurt first and then you reacted because of that. So it's really about getting to the source of why you felt what you felt. When you do go to the other person in private. You know all of this, I'm pretty sure. Never say never, never say always. Don't make generalisations, be specific. And don't start the sentence with you, because you're automatically blaming or labelling the other person. I know that we know this, it's just very hard to do it in practice when you're hurt. Start with saying positives and agreed goals, and then state how you feel. No one can argue with how you feel. I remember Archbishop Desmond Tutu was once asked, what do you think of the Aboriginal situation here in Australia? He said, well, I can't comment, but all I can say is if someone's feeling oppressed, if someone's feeling hurt, then you have to deal with what they're feeling. You can say, well, it's stupid you're feeling that way, but the reality is they're still feeling like that. Now, I need to say a proviso. Jesus doesn't say what I've just said. He just does what he wants. You brood of vipers, and then the other people are saying, the teachers of the law, Jesus, when you say these things, you offend us as well. And then he starts on them. So this might be pop psychology, and I'm not sure, but it's the way that it works for me. That's all I'm saying. Maybe Jesus was purposefully, creating conflict, and that's another issue. The other thing that creates conflict, and I'm beginning to wind up, is assumptions and misunderstandings. Probably about 80% of all conflicts can be misunderstandings and assumptions. Another one with Erica, sorry Erica, but this one puts her in a good light. Not that the other one didn't. Before we got married, she was very keen to get our house painted, and I was worried that I was going to be marrying someone who was a bit anxious over trivial things, over paint and the way things looked. So I said to her, why are you so anxious about getting our house painted? And she said, well, I came into this relationship with nothing, and you gave me a house. The least I can do is to paint it. Oh. In year 11, there was a big conflict between two groups of kids. It almost involved all the year 11s in the school. And when we sort of boiled it down, it came to a particular incident that started it between a guy and a girl A girl thought that the guy had called her flat-chested, and that was. And when it came out, he was actually talking about her hair, like your hair's flat, like mine. So everything was interpreted from that negative, and there was a big gang war, So a lot of misunderstandings and assumptions. You've heard. If you assume, you make an ass out of you and me, if you break that down. Lastly, if you have a third independent person, now Dave Andrews has done some work on this stuff in terms of the Trinity, if the conflict is so emotive, so hurtful, that both are subjective in the pain and the hurt of it all. It's really important to have a third, independent, objective person that can facilitate. And I would, if that happens to you, I would encourage you to give that facilitator as much power as you can, because I've been in that situation where, as the objective person, and I haven't had the authority to facilitate the conversation. That's really difficult, and it's very important that honesty. That you're honest about all of the problems that you have and not just sweep it under the carpet. So, let me conclude with a little story. Oh, sorry. Aim at reconciliation. The goal is to restore the relationship. The goal is not to prove who was right and who was wrong or get revenge, as it says in Matthew 18, verse 17. And if you can't get this reconciliation, then at least get suggest that you won't be negative towards each other, and that you will try and be open to each other. It's a little helpful hint. Love is can be unconditional, but trust can be conditional. I love my son, but I'm not going to trust him with a gun. So when people say, you don't love me because you don't trust me, that's not right. You can be friendly and open and like a bank account, trust grows with time. And the aim is to increase your bank account and increase your trust with the other person. And I say to kids, this is day zero. From now on, what has happened in the past is null and void. Let's pretend as if this, not pretend, but let's assume this is, start again, okay? Let me end on a story. This is a story about, you may have heard of a bloke called Robert Coles, who was a psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist. And he was at Harvard University and in the 60s when the first, he was on his way to university when a black girl was entering a school, and her name was Ruby, for the black girl for the first time. And the National Guard were there to protect her because all of these white people were yelling racist things at this little girl, 5-year-old girl called Ruby. And he thought, as a child psychiatrist, I wonder what's going on for Ruby. I wonder how she's handling this. I'd love to get inside her mind. So he tracked her down and went to a caravan at night, and it took a while for them to allow her to see, the parents to see, it took a while for the parents to allow him to see her because he was white. But as he was called the crayon man because he was the first guy that got kids to draw pictures and interpret them. So he spoke to Ruby, and Ruby, he said to Ruby, what was going through your mind when all of these people were yelling and screaming abuse at you? And she said to him, I remember Jesus on the cross when everyone was yelling abuse at him. And he said, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And I just remembered him, and so he's my example. And I don't hate those people. I just feel sorry for them. And here was a Harvard University scholar being taught by a 5-year-old kid. All his frameworks, all his academic understanding was disarmed, blown away when he heard this girl say that. She should have been traumatised. But I want to say that violence never produces peace. War cannot bring peace. The fire of hate and anger must be smothered with the blanket of love and forgiveness. It must be absorbed like a sword in the side. It goes no further and it's extinguished. And forgiveness is part of that process, and Jesus is our model. Are there any thoughts, comments about, or even questions about what I've been yarning about today? Yes?
I've just been talking about times where lack of conflict actually is not a positive thing.
Yes. That's right. Totally. No, totally. I agree. I sometimes think you need to, if something's underlying and there's a tension, you need to expose it. It's no good pretending as if everything's okay when it's not. I'm just remembering Martin Luther King, and his strategy was of creating a moment of creative tension. So he would look for the most racist county that there was and the most racist sheriff that there was and organise to a march through that land and have the national press there, you know, so to highlight it, to expose it. And just the other day, it was really interesting. I have a slightly different understanding of God and life from this other guy, and we had a meeting with a third person, And this, I wasn't expecting it. I thought it was just a lovely meeting with three guys who were theologically trained. But this guy in the middle said, you guys are very different and I want to know what's going on. I want to know the difference. And I thought, oh, gee, do we... And part of me thought, oh, this is going to be a bit of a bun fight. But it actually ended up being very helpful. So I agree, and I think you need to expose it, and you need to take responsibility and not avoid it. Just like I didn't learn that lesson, but I was pushed into it. Anything else? That's good. Bob.
This has happened, that's happened, you've been consulted enough, basically grow up, get over it. And I was thinking, but if they don't feel that way, there's something wrong here, and I don't want to do that.
Great question. I mean, this person who has the authority somehow needs to be convinced that pushing something down is actually going to create more tension in the long term. He may get his way, force and brutality. Oh, sorry.
She also said at some point, basically, if you don't like it, that it shouldn't be
here. Yeah, right. Yeah. I'll be praying for you. That's hard. John.
I just thought people might like to know there is an organisation called the Alternatives to Violence Project, and it does things by role play, and it works both in the community and in the prisons.
Yeah.
I was a member of it once.
Yeah. That's good.
It's very effective.
Yep.
If you're interested in helping people resolve what could be violent situations that the organisation belongs to.
Thank you. Sorry, Bobby, I admit I cut you off. Can I just ask, is there other people who had thoughts about Bobby's issue? Because I'm out. Yes, Rosie. That's really good advice. Thank you. Yes.
I was the person at the other end of that process once, where I'd organised a thing, failed to consult, thought I had, and people were saying to me that you didn't ask us. And I think when I was that person, I needed someone to acknowledge how hard I worked, and then to quietly let me know that there was a better way. I mean, they did. I mean, I learned. And I was young, and that's all we've learned already.
Yeah.
But sometimes people who are over controlling are working really, really hard.
Yeah.
And when somebody doesn't like what they're doing, it really, really hurts.
Yes.
And so then they defend.
Yes.
That was
me. I think that's brilliant. I think you're bang on. Everyone. everyone does something for a reason, and everyone is hurt, and we need to somehow get to the reason why they are acting that way. All right, thank you. Oh yes, go, Pete. Just a thought on that, and then we'll close. Dave Andrew has some stuff on the Book of Philemon. It's a little thing that's how to turn the world upside down and inside out. It's a little paper. And he talks about how, in a structure that's hierarchical, in an organisation, it's very hard to create a revolution, to change the culture. He said, so what you do, you reconfigure it, and you stand to the side of it, and you speak to the priest or to the boss or to the, and you have a cup of coffee outside the office. And as you do that, you create a relational space. And I've found that a lot of work can be done in a coffee shop that can't be done in a, you know, in a revolutionary organisation if you want to create a revolution.
You're absolutely right. I absolutely believe that an individual can, not just can make a difference, but inevitably does make a difference, simply by the way we talk, the way we share things, the way we think about things. But nonetheless, there is quality. There are times when you have to be dictated to by youth work is another example. You would understand this, but I was working in youth work in the East End of London. I had a choice. I either kept quiet about some of the things that I knew that the people with, that I was working with were doing, or I stopped working with them. I have to work.
Yeah.
You know?
Sometimes it's either or. Yeah. Do you want to finish? Thanks very much, Ryan. Thank you.